And that's part of that gift, I think, of the feminine lens. We can approach some of that idea of goal setting and planning in this more fluid way. But I think that it's scary for people in leadership because it takes a leap of faith. It takes more courage, I think, to go, hey, this is where we're sailing for now. Is everyone on board? Cool. And then having the courage and the humility to change track and to possibly push against structures that are in place.
I'm Sonia Statman, and you're listening to The Feminine Lens. Over the last 20 years, I've had the honor to work with thousands of women around the globe in self-development, in leadership, and in business. Being in the trenches with women has taught me that we have to stop seeing ourselves and the world through the patriarchal lens. I've spent my life helping women look through a new lens, a feminine lens, a lens that honors our innate worth and wisdom, a lens that empowers us with more wealth and freedom. The Feminine Lens is designed to challenge you. It will change what you think and what you know, but it will help you reclaim yourself. And that is the way we change the world. Ready? Let's do this. Hi, and welcome back to The Feminine Lens. I'm very excited today because I have a beautiful panel of women to talk to you about desire and vision, which is our topic this month. And so let me introduce to you this amazing panel really quick. We have Marilee McCoy. She is a facilitator, a learning designer, and a storyteller, and she is amazing. Hey, Marilee.
Hi, Sonia. Thanks for having me.
So excited you're here. And then I have with me Louise Weigel. She's a creative coach and mentor for women who are feeling stuck and that have felt like they're really abandoning their creative self. So, hey, Louise.
Hi there. Thank you for having me.
Yes, I'm so excited you're all here. And then I also have with me Michelle Hudson. After decades of working with nonprofits and associations in strategic planning, she's also coaching women leaders in this industry to gain clarity, confidence, and focus. Welcome, Michelle.
Thank you. I'm so excited to be here.
Yay. All right. Well, we are planning on having a really cool conversation today about desire and vision. And one of the reasons why I really wanted to have this particular panel of guests on is because they're all clients of mine, and we've really been working in our program around this idea of desire and vision. We've been exploring what it actually means as women, what it means in our personal individual lives, and really exploring how do we create a vision that's aligned with who we are. You know, what do you all feel like has been different about the way we've been exploring desire and vision?
I think everything that you do, Sonia, is different from the way historically I've approached it. I mean, since I work with organizations about strategic planning, I should know what vision is, right? I should be able to snap my fingers and figure it out for myself. But I think the way that you approach it is much more organic. And I think that you have to know who you are and know the underlying gifts that you bring to the table in order to figure out what your vision is. That it's not, and I think another thing that you really brought home for me is that it's not some big concrete thing that you work towards. It can be ever-changing because you're ever-changing. So your vision is not something static that you set. You know, I always hated whenever I worked in companies or interviewed for jobs where they'd say, what's your five-year plan? And I'm like, I don't know. 5 years from now, I'm going to be a totally different person. So how can I tell you what my five-year plan is going to be? And I kind of feel the same way about vision. Is I have to have a vision of where I'm going in a general sense. But I think that you have really made it a lot more clear to me that doesn't necessarily mean some destination I can put a pin in on a map. It's more of how do I want to feel? What do I want to experience in a long-term way? Not just where do I want to go with my business or where do I want to go with my family or how much money do I want to make? It has to be something much bigger and at the same time smaller because it's much more personal than what we've been led to deal with visioning for such a long time.
Yes, that's an awesome answer. Like, I feel like I can really resonate. How about you all?
Yeah, I would have said exactly what Michelle said. So she's read my script. Thank you.
Hello.
But I guess to add on a bit about my own experience through this, because I've had a very similar thing to Michelle and working a lot in organizations, I feel like I'm actually very good at creating conditions for people to explore their vision and values, like teams and that sort of stuff. But when it came to myself, I just felt like I was garbage at it. And I had a really, I think what I've learned now is that I had a bad relationship with vision and felt very much like throughout my life, I've been somebody who has variously pursued different interests, different hobbies, different careers. And I really used to beat up on myself a lot for not sticking with something. And I think what I understand now is that there's a very clear thread between all of those things, but I didn't have the awareness to sew it together as that thread of vision. And I think naming that for myself and understanding that, yeah, I can pursue what's seen as a softer goal around feeling, but is actually a much more tangible goal for me because I can tell when I've reached it. Unlike when I put hard things on there, like, oh, I'm going to get this job or I'm going to earn this much money. And then when my flow of interest changes and I feel bad about myself for not achieving that, but actually it was that wasn't the right choice for me. So I think one of the biggest things that's happened for me is just adjusting how I relate to vision for myself, for sure.
I love that. Yeah, I've definitely changed how I relate to vision as well. How about you, Luis?
Again, I would agree with both Michelle and Merrily. And even just hearing Merrily say those words, you know, I used to put sort of a really hard focus on certain things. And I would agree that I've approached it that way in the past. But I have also had times where I approach it more from my feelings. And I am normally led to something because of my feelings. But I've also wrestled with that and thought, no, I can't trust that. Or no, I can't go with my feelings because that's not what you're meant to do. And it's meant to be really rigid and a straight line. And so I actually feel relieved by knowing that the way you have taught, I guess, vision and desire does come from that place of feeling, which for me has always been there. But now, yeah, I have that sort of permission to trust it. And I don't know where I read it or heard it, but I think it's actually, you know, in the past when I've set vision, I've done it from an outside in philosophy, whereas now I'm doing it from the other way and inside out and really just getting in touch with what is right for me in spite of what other people or I guess cultural norms would normally predict. Yeah.
Do you feel like based on kind of the cultural norms and the patriarchal values and some of the way the systems are that it's hard for women to feel their desire or maybe admit their desire or give themselves permission to have desire because of everything we've been taught, right? Giving up, you know, to others, really meeting other people's desires before our own. What's your experience with that?
For sure.
Yeah, 100%.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah. You know, we're so socialized to be in service of others at the expense of our own needs. And whether you're a parent or not, I think that happens. And for me, I think I really related to what someone else in our group shared at one point around desire feeling dangerous. And I think that was definitely how it felt to me, was that if I want something and I can't have it, that's going to hurt. And I suppose what I understand now is that it's around how can I hold that a little bit differently and really embrace and explore that desire with curiosity and hope as opposed to fear of not having it. But I also think that's part of systemic structures which show women that we are not enough and we're not pretty enough, we're not thin enough, we need more. And so it's in the best interests of the patriarchal systems to keep us in line. Because if we went wild with our desires and we didn't need all those other things anymore, everything would fall apart.
That's really true. Michelle, what were you going to say?
I was going to say that's part of the issue that I've had with setting visions is that when I look back, a lot of my visions were around other people. You know, I've grown up thinking that I'm supposed to be the caregiver. I'm supposed to take care of other people, literally or figuratively. And so my desires need to be around other people. Just buying presents, it's difficult to, I can always justify spending money on other people, but I have a real hard time justifying spending money on myself. Mm-hmm. And when you say think about and write down what your desires are, I'm like, my desire? I don't know. I know what I desire for other people, or I desire a life where this person is taken care of or that person is taken care of, but I really have to step back and think about what is it that I really want out of life, and what's my vision for that life, and does it fit in with all of the things that I've been told I should want as I've been growing up? I've been told so many times, especially since I was little, you have so much potential, and I'm like, potential for what though? You know, is it potential for things that you want me to have, or is it potential for things that I want to have? And how do I define that? It's overwhelming sometimes. It really is. You just get so frustrated that you can't just step back and think about what is it I truly want, and how do I make that happen instead of trying to fit into some road that somebody else has paved for me. It's complicated.
Yeah. And I feel like for myself, every time I try to go down that road of creating desires for others, right, which I've done many, many times, like especially desires for my dad and desires for my partners, right, all these ways that every time I go down that path of trying, I just end up exhausted, burnt out, feeling like a failure, defeated. I cannot create someone else's desires. I try with a lot of effort, but it just doesn't work for me. Well, how about you guys?
I would agree. And I feel as though, I've bought into at different times perhaps what someone else has wanted for me or recommended for me as a good idea. And I've latched onto it and thought, yep, this sounds great. Go down this path. And I can stay in that mode for quite a while and be really focused about it, thinking, yeah, this is great and I'm going well. But then I still come back to a point, it may even be 5 years, and I even did a bit of a career path with illustrations of, and every 5 years, there's a point I reach where I find, hang on, this isn't what I want. Okay, we need to do a U-turn. Where am I going now? Yeah, it normally does still surface, even though I buy into somebody else's concept of what the vision they think will work for me. It resurfaces that it doesn't.
Yeah. Well, and that's what I found about desire in general. Like, we have these core desires and they're always there, right? Even when we ignore them, even when we fight with them, even when we try to create over them, even when we go down a different direction because someone else has a desire for us, they pop up eventually. It's like we can't fully, they're always constant. And so it's just about, stopping, I think, and unfolding what is there so that we can look deeper into what is that constant desire that we've kind of always had.
Yeah. Well, that's actually what I was going to add on to what you were both saying around how I hadn't thought about vision either as being a kind of living document in a way, because sometimes I would, I'd do my kind of end of year, I'd review, I'd like set a theme for the year and be like, great, that's fantastic. That's my theme for the year. And then within a month, I've like forgotten where I was heading. And I would blame that on myself and go, wow, you really suck at this. And what I've learned now is that it is a living, breathing practice that is just as valuable as any other quote unquote work that I do. And if I don't do that work, the quality of my actual work air quotes, is not as good because I'm not actually embodying that sense of where I'm heading on a daily basis. And this year has been great for that because there's been a lot of space for me, you know, not having as much work or distractions in terms of going out or whatever, to go, oh, I am just sitting here with myself. What do I want for myself, considering that the vision I had for this year is not panning out, and having to unpack that disappointment and actually start to reframe the energy in a positive way, I think was really powerful as a learning opportunity.
I love the way you frame that too. Like, I feel it is a living, breathing thing. And we so often have, I don't know, and I feel like that's really the masculine, right, is this idea that we create a goal and you stick to it, right? Like, I can't remember how many partners I've had, or my dad or whoever it was, men in my life, who were like, you can't change course. You said you committed to doing this thing and you're not finished yet. And I'm like, but I don't want it anymore.
Well, and it's so, I mean, I'm sure Michelle could also speak to this, but I see it a lot in organizations where, you know, they'll do their big plan and they're like, this is our 5-year vision and these are our values. And then they have no mechanism for people to actually engage with that and live that on a daily basis. And so by the time they get around to the next 5-year plan, the vibe of the people has gone down because they're not actually, they're just words on the wall. They're not actually things that people embody. I'm sure, I don't know if you've noticed that too, Michelle.
Absolutely. Yeah. And you may not even have the same people, or the people who are there have changed, and you know, they've either changed their role or they've changed the way they're approaching their jobs or life in general. Their whole lives have changed because they've gotten married or they have kids, and now things have changed in priority for them. It's difficult to have a 5-year plan, period, but to have one up on the wall and then to stick with it, I don't think that works anymore. I'm not even sure 3-year plans work. You know, you could have a long-term annual plan, I guess, but I'm not sure. If this year has taught us nothing, it's taught us that. You have to plan for the unplanned as much as you can, but you have to expect the unplanned and therefore be flexible enough that you can alter course if you need to. Stick with, you know, the underlying piece of where you really want to go mentally or physically, emotionally, but how you get there is going to change. It's like you want to go to New York, but the roads are all closed, then you got to figure out a different way to get there, right? And I think the same thing is true with vision or setting goals. Strategic planning definitely has to be very fluid.
And that's part of that gift, I think, of the feminine lens, is that we can approach some of that idea of goal setting and planning in this more fluid way. But I think that it's scary for people in leadership because it takes a leap of faith. It takes more courage, I think, to go, hey, this is where we're sailing for now. Is everyone on board? Cool. And then having the courage and the humility to change track and to possibly push against structures that are in place. Like, I'm talking in organizations, obviously, it's a lot more difficult to change course because you've got levels of approval and whatnot. But I think that there are courageous leaders, and I think a lot of women who are starting to do that and go, hey, we actually need to find space for us to be more human in our approach to this and have a bit more balance in the way that we take everybody along for the ride of where we want to go so that they can meet their individual goals and their individual vision. And so an organization can meet its vision too, because that whole rigid, like, we've got to increase profits by this much, I just think it's not productive in a holistic way anymore. I don't think it was productive in a holistic way before either, but.
Yeah. Well, I think that fluidity in general is really important because there is so many variables changing on a constant level. And I think if you want to, you know, create a feeling that you want to have in 5 years, or, you know, some broader kind of strokes, you know, brush strokes in 5 years, then that's fine for a 5-year plan. But when you start to take sort of this structure where you want this like very solid plan, here's our 5 years, here's what we're going to do each quarter of year one, you know, you get into these places where you're not actually, I guess, responding to what's in the moment, Whereas for me, I'm always changing my goals and my vision and my structures and what I'm creating based on kind of what's happening in the moment. And so it's like I get a feel for a desire, I get a feel for a vision, and then I start to manifest it, but I'm always open to responding to where things are, to moving or shifting or changing that needle. And I think, you know, we have been taught a lot in the world that that's not okay. That makes us, you know, weak. That makes us not, you know, able to accomplish things. That makes us wishy-washy, right? Like there's all these kind of frameworks and words that we've been told, or we're shamed if we change course, or we're shamed if we don't have enough proof for changing course. Like, why do you want to change course? Because it feels right? Well, that's not telling me anything. So there's all these ways.
Hard. Oh.
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly.
Going back to what Merrily said, I think the key word that jumped out at me is courage. You have to have the courage to, first of all, be willing to change course. And second of all, admit that maybe the course you were on isn't really the right course. And I think that it's been hard for women to have that courage, because when we step out in courage, a lot of times we're just slapped down, or like you said, we're shamed for, you know, having the audacity to be courageous. And going back to the analogy of going to New York, I think it's kind of a navigation system that, you've got the best path laid out, but then all of a sudden there's a wreck in front of you, or there's a stalled car, or there's a policeman over there when you're speeding along. You have to be willing to alter your course or change the way you're doing things to really make your destination really a successful endpoint.
Yes.
I was actually just going to add to that, you know, in terms of having the courage, I think the courage comes from the space that you have taught us is so important, but also the self-care practices and rituals that you bring into your daily life, that you can, you know, really sit and connect with yourself to know that you have the courage, or that you will gradually build the courage the more you listen to yourself. And as much as we think we're going to get that from outside ourselves, it's not the case. And it's the conversations you can have with yourself via journaling, or whether it be drawing, which is what I get my, I guess, self-trust from, and the journaling and meditation. Those sorts of practices are what help build our own inner courage to then bring that to the world.
I love that.
Yes.
I think age has a little bit to do with that too. The older you get, the more, not necessarily self-trust, but certainly the courage to speak out. I've certainly noticed that about myself. And I don't know if it's just because I've gotten older or because, I've raised a teenager. And so I have to speak out sometimes, either on behalf of him or to him. But I think age really does bring that wisdom. And maybe it's because you study more about yourself as you go through the day, or you find people like Sonia, or you find books that you read that, like Brené Brown, somebody inspires you, and your age allows you to take in that knowledge and to absorb it and to change the way you think about things. So I think age does help, but it sure would be great if we had come to this point when we were in our 20s. I know that would certainly be true for me, but we wouldn't have come to this point, right? Because we had to go through some of those experiences to get here.
Yeah, it's really interesting as I look at, you know, what would the world be like if women were in charge, right? Or if we were all looking through the feminine lens or the balanced lens, right? The feminine and masculine and balance. But, you know, what if we supported our girls to speak up from day one, right? Like, it's really interesting to think about. I think a lot of us, as we age, we just get like tired of dealing with it all. And so there's this like moment we get to where we're like, I'm just going to speak up, or I'm just going to do it because I just don't care anymore, or I'm just done with this, or I'm just fed up. But what would it be like if we never had to get fed up? Like, if we were supported to have a voice from such a young age? And I watch my girls, you know, because I've got a 6-year-old and 18-year-old. And, you know, I've supported them to have a voice, and I've supported them, you know, kind of, you know, insulated them to some degree as well. And they're both really strong in giving their opinions, like, you know, not easy as a parent, but so good for their life later on, you know. But it's interesting to think about, you know, is it that we age and get wiser? Or is it that we're just so indoctrinated, it's not till we get aged and wiser that we realize we're done with this shit?
Exactly. I have said those same things so many times, at least in my head, that that's generally when I get to the point where I'm going to speak out, is because I've said all of those things. I just can't stay silent anymore. I have to say this, whether it embarrasses you or embarrasses my son, you know, I still have to say it.
Yes, I agree. And I think the other thing that's really highlighted for me under this sort of discussion is how I think actually through this idea of vision and desire, I've come to see one of those elements of the structures, how the patriarchy also really affects men. Because I have a couple of men in my life who have been historically very unbalanced and very masculine. But when they've lent into that feminine space, that intuitive feeling space, they've just come to life. And I think, if I ever needed proof that, you know, the patriarchy affects men too, it's been in that. Because I think if men and boys were allowed to be softer and to be encouraged to be their full selves, then the world would be very different as well. Because I don't think it has to just be women running the show, but I feel like the scales need to tip, which is sometimes why I'm like, you know, we might need to go at that. But it affects all of us, all genders.
It does, 100%. And, you know, I think I talk a lot about the feminine lens because we're so imbalanced, right? You know, if we weren't so imbalanced and leaning toward that masculine lens, you know, we'd want a balance. We wouldn't just want 100% feminine. Like, that wouldn't be natural or wouldn't be helpful even. But it's that imbalance that is there. And it is absolutely there for men, right? You know, like, that's not really my lane in terms of working with men that often, you know, but I think that we need more work in this way for men as well, because they are caged. You know, women are caged and tamed in our way. Well, men are caged and tamed in theirs as well.
Yes. And I think the other aspect of that, the other way it manifests outwardly, is that even when you think about desire as a theme, that there's no space for anybody to take enough time to really feel that.
Yes.
You know, that's a place of privilege, because if you are somebody who's working minimum wage, you don't actually have the time or capacity allowed to you by your job or by your life to be able to have that emotional, mental space to ponder. And I think that's a systemic issue.
Yes.
That if we had more equality, perhaps anybody, no matter what your socioeconomic status, could be in that embodied visionary space. And it's one of the things that I get really riled up about. And I think, wow, this is part of why we need to dismantle those systems, because it shouldn't be my normal, like, only me as a middle-class white woman that I get to dream up that stuff. It should be for everybody.
Yes. Such a great point, Marilee, because it is a place of privilege that we have the space and time to contemplate this, that we don't have to, you know, worry about how we're going to, you know, get food on our table today, that we don't have to worry about, you know, that our kids are going to be arrested if they drive. If, you know, there's all these like these privileged things that we don't see that we're sitting in. And so, yeah, even this conversation, even what we're talking about on this topic is good to look through that light for sure. So I would say, and want to ask all of you, what do you feel like is, you know, based on everything that you've learned and everything you've contemplated and explored, what do you feel like is one or two tips that you would give our listeners today about how to explore their desire and vision?
Well, I think the fact that we keep talking about space is the biggest tip, is that you have to take the time, you have to create the space to really because desire, at least for me, is so deep, but it's so buried. There are so many layers of other things on top of it that I have to really, it doesn't take half an hour. You've got to do several hours because you have to peel back all of those layers in order to figure out what is my true desire. It's what is that? Something about the five whys. You have to keep asking the why question so that you get deeper and deeper and deeper into what really is the answer. Because like I said, I've created visions and desires based on helping other people. And so is my bottom line desire to help other people? Well, yes, in a way, but why? Why is that my base desire? And how can I do that and then also help myself? So that would be my biggest tip is, and I think it's something that you have kind of drilled into us, is you have to take the space. You have to take the space and the time to really, and that is definitely coming from a place of privilege. There, Merrily is so right on about that, that the fact that we can even sit here and have this conversation is so privileged, and we have to acknowledge that. But at the same time, I think that we bring so much to this world as individuals that we owe it to the world, not just to ourselves, to really live into our desires. Because if you can't figure out what your desires are, you can't figure out what your purpose is.
Yes. And, you know, I would add on, like what you said as well, add on to it. I feel like we never go far enough. So when people ask themselves what they want, and when they ask, well, why do I want that? I feel like they never go far enough, right? We always kind of stop at something that is almost like a coin word. Like, you know, one of the words I hear so often is, I want to have impact. And I'm like, but what does that mean, right? What does impact mean? Why? What is that about? What does that mean to you? What does that feel like? Because, you know, oftentimes we just don't stop enough to go deeper into what that core desire really is.
Or freedom. What does freedom mean?
Yes.
It's a concept. It's not really anything concrete that you can define. So you have to define it with little bits and pieces, which requires more than just five whys. You have to keep going until you really get to the answer.
Yeah, that's really good. How about you, Merrily or Luis? What's one tip or one encouragement you could give our listeners around desire and vision?
For me, I still come back to that sense of feeling, and that I think the thing I learnt in one of our sessions, Sonia, is that the feeling will be a knowing. Mm. But not only that, it's not necessarily something once you get to the point of that feeling, you're not going to be wrestling with it. Whereas when we're in the head, it's like you're playing tennis with yourself and you're going back and forth. But when you do get to a sense of knowing, you're not sort of in that tension or fighting with yourself. It doesn't mean to say that you don't have that on your way to getting to that feeling. And I think it is also partly surrendering and having faith, as Merrily had mentioned before. It's a surrender to letting yourself have that feeling.
Yeah, that's really good. And I feel like when desire really drops in, when we really sense it, it is like it's like almost a relaxing into, right? Merrily?
On a practical note, one of the things that's really helped me is noting when I felt on the right track. So I have a place in my regular journal where I kind of review how the week's been, and there's some aspect of that that is like what's happened, what went well, what needs to improve. But then there's an aspect of it where I just have a section which is called like embodied experiences, and that for me is a little record of times when I have felt on the right track. And I might not have been thinking, oh, I'm going to be in my desire right now, but I look back and I go, wow, that moment when I was running that workshop and someone gave me this feedback, I thought, wow, I'm really doing the thing I'm meant to do. So having that record was a really good way for me to aid my reflection when it came to doing something dedicated about desire or vision, because I could flick back through history and go, oh, here's the thread between all these occasions where I felt aligned. And so I can start to pull out the data about that. And the follow-up thing around data gathering is really, for me, starting to treat the successes and the stumbles around vision and desire as data, like actually detaching them from me being good or bad at something, because I used to do that a lot, and thinking more about what does this tell me about whether I'm aligned or misaligned. And that has been huge, because previously I would set myself a goal, run towards it, get distracted, do something else, and I'd be like, oh, you didn't reach your goal, like you're a failure. And now I go, oh, well, why didn't I reach that goal? What was it about? Oh, actually, I didn't really want to do that at all. So it lifts that burden of like a secondary job of being hard on myself. And that creates for me some of the mental and emotional space to better sit in those desires and visions, because I agree with what Michelle said. I think part of being productive and having privilege is leading the way and helping others to do that as well. So if I'm really embodying that and demonstrating that and being that fiercely, it's going to give other people permission to do that too. So that's a couple of my tips.
I love it. And I think that, you know, it's amazing how much mental space we do exert around just like beating ourselves up, right? Around just making ourselves a failure, or even trying not to be a failure, right? Like there's all these ways in which we have all this extended mental energy, emotional energy, just trying to like, it's not even relevant, right? I mean, if we looked at every goal setting process, every vision setting process, if we looked at everything we're doing as like a sign or as data or as information, we didn't judge it or make it wrong, but really recognizing what is this telling me? If we looked at it like that, we would have so much more success in getting closer to our goals, in staying aligned. It's amazing what a spiral we can get into in making ourselves wrong.
Truly, the weight that you carry in your head, right, is just phenomenal when you're thinking about things like that.
100%.
It pushes everything else out eventually, because like you said, you get into a spiral and it, you can't get out of it.
And then there's no space to create. There's no space to vision. There's no tapping into our desire.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And I think too that it is counterproductive to actually creating results as well, like hard results, if you like. I know sometimes I used to create goals out of fear or out of anxiety, and those either exhaust me or they don't happen. So I think one of the things that, and I'd be curious to know from everybody actually, like, what does it feel like? What does that knowing that Louise mentioned, what does it actually feel like? Because I think when I first started working with you, Sonia, I actually was really not particularly in touch with embodiment and physical feeling. And now for me, I know when things kind of click in terms of a desire or a vision, it's this kind of calm landing sense for me. But I'm curious to know what it is for everyone else.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. It's like a physical sensation that goes through your body. It's like opposite of adrenaline.
Interesting. Yeah.
That's a good way to describe it, Michelle. Yeah. I hadn't thought of it like that.
Me neither.
It is. It's calm. There's no resistance, perhaps. And for me, like I'd said before, it's a surrender, but not in a way, victim way or anything like that. It's purely accepting what is, and it is a bodily sensation. It actually does make me think about the Glennon Doyle book, and the middle section of her book, she has the chapters Feel, Know, Imagine, and Let It Burn. And that last section of Let It Burn reminds me of that place of where you're coming to knowing because you're having to let go of what was before. It's simplifying things for one, but it's you're just letting it burn. Whatever was before, you have to let it burn, and you have to let it burn over and over and over in order to let that the next step in.
Kind of like a grieving process.
Mm.
You're grieving for what you thought you needed or what you were told you needed. You're grieving for the past that didn't happen.
Yeah. It's interesting because what I love about what we're talking about now is this idea that, you know, desire and vision, it unfolds, right? Like, you know, I think so many people think they should just sit down and calculate their goals, right? They should just sit down for a 30-minute session and be like, my goals for this year are A, B, C, D, and E. And it actually, like, real desires, real goals, it's almost like they percolate or they brew, right? There's like, I don't ever find that my big goals or my big visions just like unfold in one breath, right? Like, it's over time. I might get a trickle of it and then another trickle, and then I have to let go of something or let it burn, you know, as Louise said. And then I get to a place where it lands, and then I'm like, here it is, right? Yeah. Well, thank you all for joining me. We're going to wrap up. Is there any last words you want to say or anything you want to add before we go?
I just want to say a quote that I heard recently, and I don't even remember where I heard it. It may have been from you, Sonia. somebody said that your resume and your eulogy shouldn't be the same. So I've been kind of thinking into that. It's not about what I've accomplished on my resume. It's how I've been in the world and who I've affected, who's affected me, how I've gone through the world. I think that's much more important than whether I made $1 million this year or got that job.
Anyone else?
Yeah, I think I would just say that in this process of exploration, as I said, it does take courage. And I think there's also patience with yourself because the answers don't come in a linear way on your own timeline. And it is a bit scary because that's not how the world functions. And for me, I've really been more and more emboldened to just hold tight to that for myself, being my own system. And, you know, part of my job is very creative, and sometimes that doesn't unfold the way that I want on the timeline that I want. And I've had to just show up and be honest with people about that and just say, yeah, I'm not sure yet, or here's what I think it looks like, but it's still unfolding. Because I think I felt a lot of shame for a while about not being able to put kind of high quality defining words on my process or how I was feeling or what I saw in the future, but I know the direction. And so a few times recently, I've actually said either to clients or to colleagues, I don't have good words for this, but I need you to trust that I know where we're going. And that's a big investment in myself and backing myself, but also showing them that I'm not going to compromise just because it makes them more comfortable if I conform to the traditional masculine way of defining this stuff. And I think that that is a really important part of almost activism, really, to go, we can show up differently. We just need to say it and be uncompromising in it.
I love that, Marilee.
We're all works in progress.
Yeah, for sure. All right. Well, thank you all for joining us this week, and we will see you next week. Thanks so much for listening to The Feminine Lens. If you're a woman in business and tired of trying to operate through the traditional patriarchal lens, check out my group program. You get the chance to apply these podcast topics to your life and business. You'll find coaching, support, and new perspectives on how to grow your business with more alignment and freedom. You'll be surrounded by amazing women and transform the way you feel about your value, your voice, and the gift you are bringing to the world.
just head over to soniastatman.com. All right, see you next week.